Christopher Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000 watt sports leader. Maybe we should, you know what? Maybe I should start as if it's, you know, people are trying to get up. Good morning. This is your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, Central Valley, and for you late risers who need a little white noise to sleep a little longer, we're here to help. God, that's lame. 940 ESPN. 940 ESPN Fresno.com. Your 2 hour tour begins right now. 5 minutes, no, 6 minutes, 2 seconds past the hour of 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. I am the host of this program, Christopher Gabriel. Good morning to you. It is a beautiful morning here in the Central Valley of California. I hope it's beautiful wherever you happen to be waking up. Producer of the program, we call him Gonzo. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
You want to weigh in during the program? You can always do that, 844-940-3776. Follow me on Twitter. I hope you do. Everybody in this room does, and we all follow each other. It's a great little party. At CG Program, you can follow Gonzo at
JLGonzo21.
Every minute of this program, for better or for worse, you can find it, you can listen to it, you can laugh at it, or you can absorb it. 940 ESPNFresno.com. You go to the website, you'll go to the podcast column. Gonzo, tell them what they do.
Hover,
baby. You got to hover. You got to hover, and then you're going to get the drop down. It's like magic, and you're going to see the Christopher Gabriel program, Sports Line, Justin Hudson Coach's Show. It's a great, great thing. You can email this program anytime. You can email the program to say, oh, I don't like the way you open the program. You can do that too, CGP at 940ESPNFresno.com. On the program today, our encore of the week. We really enjoyed our conversation earlier in the week with Congressman Jim Costa. He put forth a House resolution last week to bring awareness and attention to the fact that Tom Flores, legendary coach Tom Flores, Valley guy, is not yet in the Hall of Fame. Count me in as one who, even though I didn't grow up here, I certainly followed his career. It's incredible to me that Coach Flores is not in the Hall of Fame yet. And so Congressman Costa put that out there, and then we brought him on to talk football. And it's a great conversation. If you missed it, you're going to get a chance to hear it at 7:35. At 8:05, the big man's in the house, Derek X. We're talking some boxing. We might even talk a little Terrence Crawford and Conor McGregor. That should be kind of fun. He's telling me about a possibility of a dual fight. I don't know what that is. Well, yes, I do. And I'm looking forward to getting his thoughts on that and some other things. Nick Shager will join me at 8:35, and Nick has a couple of cool things, but one of them is the pharmacist. And wait till you hear about this. This was a story that I was unfamiliar with. That it is now. I believe it's a Netflix series. Yes, it's a Netflix docuseries, and this looks pretty intense. I'm looking forward to that. We should give you a little heads up. Also, of course, tomorrow UNLV is in town at the Save Mart Center to take on your 19-4 undefeated in Mountain West play, 12-0 Fresno State women's basketball team. And then on Monday, we're going to have some members of the basketball team in here. I think Coach White's going to be here, and she'll probably bring a player along. That's at, I believe, 4:35. I forget which time, because 4:05. I think it's 4:05, 4:30. I forget which way. I've got them switched, but it doesn't matter. The entire Fresno State women's golf team is going to be here. Not just head coach Emily Lofton, not just Bridget Tebow, not just Daniel Richmond, everybody. They're all going to be here. I told Emily last year, at the end of last year, you know what, when we get you on the program again, why don't we just bring them all in? And Emily sent me a text yesterday and said, I'd like to bring the whole team in. I said, I'd like to have the whole team. So we're going to get the whole team in here. That is going to be a lot of fun. We have been talking, certainly we've been talking about what's going on with Major League Baseball. A lot of things going on with Rob Manfred. They're going to be trying robo-umps. We had Jacob Borgage on with us from the Washington Post talking about Major League Baseball. And in spring training, they're going to do what the minor leagues did or tried out last year, and that is having robo-umps, essentially having this three-dimensional software that will immediately send a signal to the umpire behind home plate, whether it's a ball or strike, and he will then make the call. I mean, I wonder how much of that, and this is not what we're talking about this morning, but Gonzo, I wonder how much of that, if there's going to be a little bit of a delay, because what we're so used to seeing in baseball is pitch comes in and it's instantaneous where you get the, you know, whatever the call is, or you just see him look away. And now is there going to be a 1 second delay, or if there's any kind of hiccup? I mean, it's a computer system. It's a software program. And just like every office in the world, computers freeze. Things happen. Things go wrong. Sometimes people steal signs. Oh, wait, that's a different story. Things go wrong. What's going to happen when a pitch comes right down the middle? It's 3-2, bases loaded, team is down by a run. Here's the pitch, and we're waiting. Because you know it's going to happen sooner or later.
Yeah, I think it would happen. And again, Major League Baseball has to make sure these hiccups are completely out of it before rolling it out.
But wait a minute. That I'm glad you said that. Because that's like you and I coming to work, and you're in the control room, and you've got 900 monitors around you and computers everywhere. I'm in here with a couple of monitors, and somebody could say to us, well, you should make sure that everything's working right before you. And how many times have we been on when just a computer freezes? The computers freeze. It's going to happen.
It is. And again, like looking at it, I think you will have a 1 to 2 second delay. I don't think it's going to be that noticeable, but I think it's going to be very noticeable to us at first, because when they finally roll it out, we're going to be paying attention to the umpire, something we don't do very often. We're going to be looking at them to see how fast it takes them to say strike or ball.
I'm telling you, I am waiting for that moment. I don't know how they're going to avoid it, because I can't stress the point enough that we all know laptops, desktops, our phones, they freeze. Things go wrong. Just because things go wrong, and something's going to go wrong sooner or later.
And based off what we talked to Jacob about, it's going to be one of those AirPods in the ear and the iPhone in the pocket. It's going to be based off Bluetooth. What if the Bluetooth goes bad? What if the iPhone glitches at that moment? Like, there's a lot of things that go to it.
And the fact is, certainly you've gone to a stadium or an arena and you've tried to use your phone, and I don't care how good the Wi-Fi is there, when you have 35, 40,000 people using Wi-Fi, things get slower. I'm just waiting for, here's the pitch. Right to, and you know it's a strike, and everybody's waiting. And then you see the umpire's hands are going to go up. Time. Just waiting on that call. Just waiting to find out if it is a strike. Just waiting to find out. And then a whole stadium is waiting.
I see. That's the thing. I'm assuming they'll have, like, they should, right? They should have a procedure if something like that happens. I say they should, but I don't know if common sense will come over in that situation.
And what would that be, though? Would an umpire, if the system goes down, will the umpire have the latitude to call the ball or a strike? And then if the other team doesn't like the call, if it's on the corner, if it looks like it's off the corner, or if it just looks like it's completely out of the strike zone and he calls a strike, is a team going to put a game under protest? I mean, I understand this is why they're practicing it or working with it in spring training to work out the kinks, but they will never be, I don't care that it's Major League Baseball or any professional league, they'll never be able to work out the kinks of a computer potentially freezing.
Yeah, because Jacob mentioned the fact that they can overrule the system if it's something outrageous, if the ball bounces and goes into the strike zone.
And that's a whole other can of worms, is it not?
Yeah.
So you're watching your beloved Braves, who didn't win anything last year, and I just point that out because you told me they were going to win it all, so don't come back with your White Sox stuff. Bring something better than that. I kid because I care. But you're watching the Braves, and the Braves are playing the Nationals, and it looks like they're getting ready to sweep and clinch a division, you know, a division championship, and then there's a computer malfunction, and then the umpire decides to make a call, and then everybody, it all breaks loose, and you're losing your mind. You're getting the flamethrower from Lady Ashley, and you're lighting each Braves hat on fire because you're so upset.
That's again, it could happen in the aspect of things can go wrong. Things can just not work, function, and glitch, and this, or like, what if the system glitches and something that's a strike is called a ball, and like, what's going to happen in those situations?
Right. Exactly right. All right. So here's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about Hank Aaron, because the scandal with the Astros, and we've not yet heard the final decision on the Red Sox. Let me just review this with you. A.J. Hinch, manager of the Astros, was suspended for the entire 2020 season. He was then fired by the Astros owner. So even if he goes somewhere else, he's not going to go anywhere else because he's not going to have a job. He's not going to be able to go in anywhere. GM Jeff Luhnow, also suspended for the 2020 season. He was fired by the Astros. Former assistant GM Brandon Taubman, suspended 1 year. The Astros have forfeited their first and second round draft picks for the next 2 years. That's brutal. Astros were fined $5 million. That's the maximum allowed under Major League Baseball's constitution. Now, the problem here for a lot of fans, a lot of media members, a lot of other people in baseball, and a notable person in baseball history, he, the owner of 755 career home runs, Hank Aaron, one of the true dignitaries of the game as well, said this. He was asked, do you think the punishment fit the crime? And he said, no, I don't. This is his exact quote. No, I don't. I think whoever did that should be out of baseball the rest of their life. He thinks the players got off too easy. I do too. Now, I understand that Major League Baseball most likely, and we've talked about this, everybody's talked about this, found a few players that knew stuff and likely, we don't know this for sure, but likely gave them immunity to give them the information they wanted so that they could go after whoever they felt were the main culprits, A.J. Hinch, Jeff Luhnow. They're the top of the food chain. But I have said all along that the people who benefited from this were the guys in Astros uniforms coming to the plate. Those are the guys. And it wasn't like this was lost upon them. It wasn't like you had Hinch and Luhnow knowing what was going on. You had somebody giving a signal on garbage cans, you know, doing that. Who were they giving signals to? They were giving signals to the guys at the plate. Now, you still have to hit a baseball. Understand that. But now you have A.J. Hinch coming out yesterday and saying, I think it's an easy read that people can say our championship was tainted. Well, Mr. Hinch, we're glad you got to that conclusion because everybody else got there weeks ago. So I'm in agreement with Hank Aaron. Are you going to throw out 20 guys, 25 guys? Are you going to throw out all those guys in baseball for the rest of their lives? Probably not. But should there have been bigger penalties? Absolutely. Imagine a bench-clearing brawl in hockey. They don't have those really that much, if ever, anymore because there are severe penalties. I shouldn't say severe, but there are penalties for when you come off the bench in a fight. It wasn't that way up through probably up to the 1990s. You had the Broad Street Bullies. You had the big bad Boston Bruins. And the original 6 days, those teams just went to war. And having a night where there were 300-plus minutes of penalties, it wasn't unusual. But imagine back then, you had 10 guys brawling, and I was at those games that you'd have 10 guys brawling, and you'd have the referee and two linesmen. It was only one referee then, and they would just be they'd be standing there with their arms folded, watching this because the three guys couldn't handle it, so they'd let everybody fight it out, and then little by little they would start breaking people apart. But imagine you've got 10 guys fighting, five individual fights going on, and then you have more guys fighting, and then when the referee decides to start giving out penalties, he only gives out penalties to the first two guys who started it. All the other guys who also were fighting, who also came off the bench, and who were also adding to the mayhem on the ice, because then you've got 30 to 40 players on the ice. All those other guys, nobody else gets penalties. I remember plenty of times seeing penalty boxes with four and five guys in each box, the guys who weren't given game misconducts. You'd have four or five guys crammed into tiny little penalty boxes, and it would be 3-on-3. You'd have 3-on-3 out there for an extended period of time. Well, in Major League Baseball, this is a version of that, because you had plenty of guys on the Houston Astros, and I'm being sarcastic, you had an entire team coming to the plate, anybody who was playing, anybody who was inserted, benefiting from what they had set up with their electronic sign stealing, and I quite frankly don't understand how they cannot penalize anybody else involved with this. I think it is a major fail from Rob Manfred, and I couldn't agree more with Hank Aaron. Whether you throw them out of baseball, that's a different story. You can certainly make that argument that they cheated the game, and that's why you and I talked about the Pete Rose situation the other day.
Yeah, we did. And again, we don't know what's going to happen with the Boston Red Sox and what punishment they're going to receive, because they're also implicated in a cheating scandal, as well as the whole situation with the Apple Watches as resurfacing as well now. Alex Cora, I think that if you don't ban him for life or something to that effect, now you're letting everybody off completely easy. And I agree and I disagree with Hank Aaron at the same time. Hank Aaron hasn't been one of those purists that a lot of the older guys in right. baseball are. He accepts analytics. He's been around Braves camp and he does all those things. But like again, sources say immunity was given to the players so that they can get to the bottom of it. I don't know if the punishment fit the crime. I think Carlos Correa, Jose Altuve, these guys that were so brash, right? They were like acting like if they were these guys that did nothing wrong, that were the best, and it's just
they were arrogant.
Yeah, and now you look at everything that's happening. They haven't faced the cameras, and we wait to see when they finally say, "Hey, we're sorry for what we did," because they didn't do that when they first faced the cameras. Again, I think someone needed to be banned for life. Maybe it's Alex Cora, but we wait to see.
No, that's exactly right. We wait to see. And I mean, I don't know where you start with penalties, but I don't think that Major League Baseball has sent a strong enough message to Major League Baseball. I don't think that they've sent a strong enough message to everybody to be strong enough to dissuade other teams. And then what was it that Will Clark said the other day? Well, they got caught.
Yeah.
I mean, Will Clark was on this program, and he was as genuine a guy as we've ever had on this program from professional sports, really from any level of sports. And when he said that, and maybe I'm paraphrasing, but I think those were his words, that they got caught. I mean, and he said it with a wry, a grin and a chuckle. You know, he said that here, and the subtext from what he said was, come on. You really think that this is the first time this has happened? I mean, that was I'm putting words in his mouth, but that's what I was getting from what he said, Gonzo.
That's exactly what I got as well. And I've had arguments with a couple of people about that kind of thing. I've said, hey, there's one thing when there's someone on second and you know they're trying to steal your signs, where you're mixing it up, you're changing it up, you're doing it because someone's on base. But when there's no one out there, there's no thought in your head that I should be changing my signs because there's no one on base. And I'm not expecting there to be cameras watching my catcher as he puts down signs.
Exactly. And we got an email from Christina. I haven't heard from Christina in quite a while. CGP at 940 ESPNFresno.com. Christina said Pete Rose's attorneys make a good point by advocating for him to be reinstated since none of the players were duly punished, only the coaches. I can't argue with that, and we made that case the other day. I have said And I've always been in the camp that Pete Rose should be the player, should be in the Hall of Fame. And if you want to put an asterisk by his name, by his plaque, if you want, whatever you have to do, Pete Rose, the player, got the 4,200, whatever it was, 4,300 hits. You want to qualify it some way? That's fine. Because as we discussed, as Marty Lenz and I discussed the other day, if you want to suddenly turn this into the Baseball Hall of Morality, then there's going to be a whole bunch of guys that aren't in there anymore, starting with Ty Cobb and going right down the list. You want to go down and start finding things about every guy that you, whatever somebody decides. And I get it. Somebody's saying, well, it's different. He bet on baseball. Right. But they're making a judgment. He bet on baseball. But now, if you want to juxtapose what went on with the Houston Astros, are you telling me that what the Astros did was somehow okay versus what Pete Rose did? Pete Rose was standing on the dugout steps of the dugout phone making bets. It's reprehensible as a manager. There's no two ways about it. But he didn't do it as a player. That's what we understand. Correct?
There's belief he might have done it
okay.
as a player.
So then we'll go with that for a moment. There's because it's been so long that I've forgotten every single detail about it. But the point is, The bigger point here is, when you look at Pete Rose gambling on baseball, is that appreciably worse than what the Astros did? My answer is no. I'm by no means exonerating Rose for what he did. And again, we said this the other day, Pete Rose could have helped himself by not lying for 15 years.
Yeah.
He was as arrogant as some of the Astros. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was just, how dare you come at me and tell me that I'm doing something wrong here. That got old, because finally he went on the contrition tour.
Yeah, and for me personally, my issue with this is, okay, are you going to make the Astros players ineligible for making it into the Hall of Fame? Is that part of the punishment? It isn't. So if you're not making them ineligible to enter the Hall of Fame, how are you going to keep Pete Rose out of the Hall of Fame?
Well, that's right. That's right. And I don't know if the reason is that because of Bart Giamatti and going back, if they feel that every commissioner feels like they have to continue to follow through with this. And a lot of times I believe that they just dismiss Pete Rose and his attorneys out of hand. This is the second time that he has put in a 15 to 20 page document saying, all the reasons why he wants to be reinstated. And he said he's apologizing. We get all that. But at some point, I think Major League Baseball has a problem here. And that is, it is a problem of optics. I know it's an overused term, but the optics here are that you're saying Pete Rose did something that has banned him for life from the game, and he has no chance of getting in the Hall of Fame. But yes, we have actual evidence here that the Houston Astros cheated, and it was one of the most extensive, methodically prepared cheating scandals we've ever seen in sports. Everybody was in on it, but no players are getting hurt by it. To me, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and I want to equate it to the steroid era, right? Everybody knows those guys cheated, but yet they have an opportunity to get into the Hall of Fame. They're there. They're on the ballot, and the writers are deciding whether they're worthy to be inside the Hall of Fame. They weren't excluded. We know Barry Bonds, right? We know Barry Bonds cheated, but I believe the dude was still one of the best in the game because he still was able to hit the ball and everything to that effect. But again, they're on the ballot. Like they have the ability. If the writers decide that they are good enough without the steroids, they're gonna get in. I don't understand keeping Pete Rose out, other than saying, you know what, he did something that was against the rules, but now we have this with the Astros.
Right. And again, I'll never say I'm not making a case for Pete Rose as though he's some sort of wonderful, dignified statesman of the game. He's not. That's not who Pete Rose is. And that's not who he was. That's not who he is. That's not who he ever will be. But if you want to look at something in sports that redefines double standard, this is it. This is absolutely it. All right. Coming up is our Encore of the Week. Congressman Jim Costa came by to talk about Tom Flores and just how ridiculous it is that he is not yet in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. That is next. Glad you're with us. Good morning to you. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN. Christopher Gabriel returns.
What you say?
Congressman Jim Costa has put forth a resolution on the floor of the House to bring some awareness and hopefully do a little more to, I think, correct a wrong, and that is that Tom Flores is not in the Professional Football Hall of Fame. Joining me right now to explain all of this is indeed Congressman Jim Costa. Congressman, welcome to the program. It's great to have you aboard.
Well, Christopher, it's great to be on ESPN Sports Talk. I mean, the fact is you do a terrific job. And for all of us who are sports lovers in our valley, we've had such incredible sports heroes and heroines over the years, whether we're talking about football and the coach Tom Flores, our baseball, our basketball, both past and present. And Coach Tom Flores, I suspect, like for you, for me, was one of my boyhood heroes. You know, I remember him as a quarterback for the Oakland Raiders in the early 60s and first Hispanic quarterback in the NFL. And then he played the last time the Chiefs won the Super Bowl as a backup to Lenny Dawson, where he earned his first Super Bowl ring. And then in 1977, he was an assistant coach to Coach John Madden, in which he earned his second Super Bowl ring. And then Al Davis made him head coach after Madden retired. And as we all know, he had that storybook Cinderella year in 1980 where the Oakland Raiders were a wild card team and they ran the table. Playing the Philadelphia Eagles in the Super Bowl and beating them with Jim Plunkett coming on the scene. And that was a terrific victory. No team had ever, as a wild card, had been able to run the table and win the Super Bowl. And then he repeated that feat, although they were, I think, AFC champion. In 1983, they were the Los Angeles Raiders at the time, again with Jim Plunkett. And an incredible team that they had, and they beat the Washington Redskins, where he earned his fourth Super Bowl ring. And then later on in the 80s, he became coach and general manager. That's a difficult task to hold both jobs for the Seattle Seahawks. So in the 60s, the 70s, and then the 80s, Coach Tom Flores was one of the real pillars of establishing the National Football League for what it is today in its 100th anniversary. But we all know in the 60s it was the merging of the AFC and the NFC into the NFL that really changed the whole dynamics of professional football. And then, of course, in the 70s and the 80s, as it gained in exposure and popularity throughout the country and might I say now throughout the world. I mean, they're playing in London and they're playing in Mexico City. And of course, for those of us in the Valley, I mean, his days in Sanger as a terrific athlete and going to UOP when they had a football team in the late 50s and being the star quarterback for University of Pacific and then being drafted by the Raiders. I had a nice conversation with Coach Flores on Friday, and he lives down in Palm Springs now, but you know, he talked about, like, once you're a Valley kid, I think you're always a Valley kid, and certainly his fondness and his friends that he has here. He's got the Tom Flores Youth Foundation that has raised over $2 million for youth, both in as it relates to academics and science and athletics and giving back, as he always said. He's 82 years old now, though, and we got to get him in Canton, Ohio, in the National Football Hall of Fame, because you know, you don't want it to be like Cliff Branch where they're trying to, you know, give him that honor after he's passed on. So,
right.
Coach Flores was kind of funny. He says, "Hell," he said, of course, you know, a lot of teams have more players and coaches in the Hall of Fame than other teams. He says, "They're liable to put the ball boy for the Pittsburgh Steelers in the Hall of Fame before I get there."
Well, yeah, they have a pretty good class going in this year, certainly. We're talking with Congressman Jim Costa, who put forth a resolution in Congress to try and raise awareness and maybe, let's put it in quotes, encourage some voters to be aware of someone that all of us out here know is a coach who is well worthy of being in the Hall of Fame. You know, you mentioned a couple of things there that certainly got my attention. You mentioned the Oakland Raiders winning the Super Bowl against the Eagles. My family had moved from Chicago to Philadelphia in 1972, so I remember that Super Bowl very well, beating a team of Ron Jaworski, Wilbert Montgomery, Bill Berge, and Harold Carmichael, and that was a magical year for them under Coach Flores. And you mentioned that he was the first Hispanic starting quarterback. Sanger High School, of course, renaming their stadium, Tom Flores Stadium. There was one of your whereas in the resolution that I was unaware of, and that is that Coach Flores is one of only two people in National Football League history to win multiple Super Bowls as a player, assistant coach, and head coach. You would think, Congressman, that there would be more than two, but he is one of two. And when you look
and the
at
other,
oh, go ahead,
Mike
sir.
Ditka. The other was Mike Ditka,
and
who's already in the Hall of Fame,
as it should be, a Chicago Bear. Congressman, don't you think? And I know that I'm preaching to the choir here, but don't you think, with the record that you outlined here a moment ago, and that is in the resolution, and then the fact that it is so notable that he's one of just two, those factors alone should put him in the Hall of Fame?
I would think so. But, you know, as Coach Flores and I spoke on Friday, and we're doing more research, and your listeners, I'm sure, would want to get behind this and support the resolution. But there are 42 votes every year that determine who gets in on the amount of slots that they have between players and coaches. And, of course, Coach Flores would qualify in both counts. But 32 of the voters are sports writers from the cities where they have NFL franchises. So sports writer from San Francisco, from Oakland, although that will now change, I guess, to Las Vegas. And, you know, the Kansas City and New York. And so how these sports writers are selected, I'm trying to determine. And then the other 10 votes, 42 or 12, one is a sports writer who covers football for Sports Illustrated. Another is a sports writer for USA Today. And then I'm still trying to figure out who the other eight are. But the I think part of the challenge we have in terms of the education, because on merit, it's hands down, right, Christopher? I mean, gee.
Yeah.
But is that a lot of these sports writers, you know, have been covering sports for maybe the last 20 years. And the 60s and the 70s and even the 80s, for many of them, seem like ancient history. And so I think that's part of the challenge we face. And, of course, we've got to do that education. And I'm trying to, not only with this resolution, but we're going to have another conversation with Coach Flores later this week or the following week, and find out, you know, how we can better coordinate our efforts so that throughout this year we can create the sort of awareness that I think needs to be made. And we might, with your listeners, want to start a letter writing campaign or an email campaign. We're going to have to figure out where we want to, who we send that to. I think we ought to also talk about this conversation with the commissioner of the NFL.
Well, Congressman, if I may interrupt, what you're saying is spot on, and it reminds me sometimes of when a popular television show gets canceled and people just rise up and say, I think you're mistaking this here. You're making a mistake. And then suddenly it comes back. When you put this resolution on the floor, I think it was last week. Correct me if I'm wrong, but when you put this resolution on the floor, the question, because I talked to some friends about this, the question they had is, what is the hope of the resolution to simply raise awareness, to make it to bring Tom Flores back in the front of the consciousness of people who are involved with this?
Yes, I mean, we want to try to raise his exposure for all that he's accomplished in what has been now become one of America's biggest sports venues, which is the NFL, celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. But clearly, I think the focus of the strategy has got to be, to a large extent, at these 42 sports writers. You know, the NFL, and just seems to me that, you know, there's got to be, I think, a more effective strategy to get this on the radar screen of these 42 people that have a vote, so that we can, unlike baseball, I'm told, where you only have a limited amount of chances, football doesn't subscribe to that rule, is my understanding.
Correct.
Like Major League Baseball. So that's at least on our side. But, you know, the resolutions to raise awareness on a bipartisan basis. And I think there are other venues and organizations that might get behind this.
Might seem like a bit, we're talking with Congressman Jim Costa regarding the resolution that he put forth on the House floor in Washington, D.C. to raise awareness and to correct what I will say I believe is a wrong, that Tom Flores is not in the National Football League Hall of Fame. What does Coach Flores think about this? Does he, I'm guessing, Congressman, that he just sort of maybe passes it off a little bit and says, well, you know, hopefully it'll happen. But I've got to believe this is frustrating for him on a certain level.
No, I got a sense of that. I mean, he is a class act, yeah, and a very, you know, polite gentleman. And so, you know, and he's certainly, you know, I mean, he's seen it all in terms of his 30 years plus in sports, and especially the NFL. And he says, you know, some people say, you know, I ought to maybe publicly complain or say some things. But he says, you know, that's not my style, number one. And number two, you know, that could, you know, also potentially be a backlash that might come from it. I don't want to do that. And so he said, Jim, you know, maybe the third time's the charm. So I think those of us who believe on merit that he deserves to be there, then, you know, I think this is part of a larger effort, and certainly for your listeners that are tuning in, don't hesitate to call our office and as we try to put this campaign together to see that a Valley guy that worked hard, families were farm workers, his parents, and you know, still has a lot of you know, contact, that one of our own get there in Canton, Ohio, and who knows, Christopher, when we get that to happen, maybe you and I will go there at the Youngstown and watch him being sworn in. I know you'd get some good coverage on it.
That would be fantastic. And I was going to say, you know, you're not too far from where we're located here downtown. Anytime you want to come down, bring the staff and hang out and talk a little football or whatever you'd like to talk about, we could certainly do that. I have one last thing for you, and as you would imagine, Congressman, we have sources. We have lots of sources in different parts of the country, sports and otherwise, and I do have a source in your office, and your source told me I should ask you about something. This is an interesting combo platter here, and I'm just going to read these three things off to you, and hopefully you won't say I have no idea what you're talking about. the natural resources hearing, Richard Gere and Arctic blonde hair.
Well, it was a Foreign Relations Committee hearing. That part was a little bit off.
But okay.
He was testifying on the Dalai Lama, and I went and introduced him, myself to him, and we talked a little bit about the subject matter that he was testifying on. And he looked at me and he said, Costa, he says, I like your hair. And I said, his hair was obviously the same color as mine. I says, well, I says, back in the valley, we call it Arctic blonde. I like yours too.
Well, you know, let's just say you are both individuals that do have outstanding hair. Let's just call it what it is, Congressman.
Well, thank you. Biden's always joked with me. He says, Costa, if I had hair like yours, maybe I could have been president. Who knows?
Oh, my gosh. Well, folks, he is Congressman Jim Costa, and we've been having a great conversation about a resolution that he put forth on the House floor to bring awareness about former head coach Tom Flores and the myriad of accomplishments that Coach Flores has accrued in his great career throughout the National Football League, most notably with the then Oakland Raiders and now the Las Vegas Raiders. Congressman,
that's going to be hard for me to get used
to
saying that.
There's no question about it. Congressman, I'm delighted that you put this forth, and I know some people will say, because there's always going to be people that will say, you know, don't they have anything else to do? Well, it's funny thing about folks like yourself and others that you can actually do more than two or three things at one time. And this is one of them. And I think it's great that you're taking up the cause for Tom Flores. Anytime we can be of help, please let us know. And as I said, it'd be great to meet you in person sometime.
Well, no, I'd like to do that and tell Paul, who does such a great job with his broadcasting for the Bulldogs, that I said hello, and I see him. He does this effort for the veterans where they come to Washington, and it's such an incredible effort that they make. But there's so many good people in our valley that do so many things that are incredible. And I'd love to come just talk to you about sports. You know, I mean, not only we got Coach Flores, you know, we had Stephon Page and Henry Eller and
yes.
Kevin Sweeney and, I mean, the football legendaries going all the way back to Frank Gifford from Bakersfield. Now I'm really dating myself. but, you know, in baseball, I mean, you think about the incredible, in the 60s, we had four starting pitchers who all made their mark, whether we're talking about Wade Blasingame or Jim Maloney, who pitched for the Cincinnati Reds, the first holdout at $40,000, I think it was Dick Ellsworth with the Chicago Cubs, and then later on the Boston Red Sox, and then Tommy Terrific Seaver, who made it on the first ballot
sure.
into Cooperstown. You know, our track athletes are, you know, legendary. Some went to my little high school, San Joaquin Memorial. You know, people like I left out Darrell LaMonica. I mean, you think about it. Think about the quarterbacks that have played for the Raiders. Tom Flores, Darrell LaMonica, and now Derek Carr. So the Valley contributions to athletics and all of the major sports, have been heroes for all of us, and many of us got the chance to watch them.
Nope.
In their formative years in high school and college, and then succeed in their professional sport. So we're proud of all of them.
Well, that's very well said. He is Congressman Jim Costa. Congressman, a great pleasure to have you on the program, and I look forward to meeting you, as I said.
Okay, you keep up the good work. ESPN Sports Talk. I love it.
Thank you, sir. Much appreciated. That's great. Congressman Jim Costa, I love this resolution. I love what he's trying to do for one of the true legends from the Raiders and throughout the National Football League, and that is Tom Flores. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN. More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Georgia. The whole day through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ray Charles.
Just an old sweet song.
It is Retro Bumper Friday.
Keeps Georgia on my mind.
Keep Georgia on all of our minds. Shout out to my mom listening this morning in Philadelphia. My mom is from Georgia. She gets up and listens on Friday mornings. Well, it's not she's up. I mean, it's almost 11 o'clock there. She, you know, she's not sleeping in past me. She listens to the show in the afternoons, too.
Nice. On the app?
On the app, yeah. She takes her, she sits down, her and my dad. They'll sit down. It's 6 p.m. They'll have dinner, you know, but they sit down. God bless them. They're both in their upper 80s. And they will sit down. They have matching little matching leather recliner chairs. And they go into one of the rooms in the house where they run the app through the TV speakers, and they listen to the show.
That's awesome.
I just love that. Yeah. I just love my mom. You know, my dad is a Southsider, Chicago, so he's still. You know, I got my teams from him, just like you got yours. I think from your grandfather.
Yeah,
yeah. That's kind of what we do, right? Whether it's dad or mom, we get our teams from the dominant sports fan in the family. But what's funny for me, and I wonder how many can relate to this, and I wonder if you can, Gonzo, and Derek sitting here listening as well. He'll be on in just a couple of minutes. We'll be talking boxing. Is my mom is a sports fan lunatic. She listens to Philly Sports Talk Radio. She listens to me. She'll listen to a couple of national people. That's what she loves. This is a woman who has played the piano by ear for 84 years. She's brilliant, but she is a sports nut. She'll send me texts. It'll be 2 in the morning. And she'll be getting up early to listen to somebody, and she'll send me a text saying, "Did you hear what so and so said?" And she's like, "Can you tell him?" So it's like, "Well, I don't, Mom. I don't know him. Coming up in hour number 2, we talk with the big man, Derek X. We're talking a little Terrence Crawford and Conor McGregor, and a couple of other fighters that you're going to want to hear about, and one great name that is my new favorite boxing name. I'm saving that for you. This is the CGP. Good morning.
Georgia, no peace, no peace I find. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia.
Your home of the Los Angeles Lakers, 940 ESPN, the Valley's local sports leader, KFIG Fresno. Live from the studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California, this is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number 2, CGP. Working our way to the Saturday, which is women's basketball, and just an exciting weekend and week ahead. Hour 2 begins right now, 4 minutes, 35 seconds past the hour of 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Glad to have you aboard. CGP rolling through on 940 ESPN. And I just took a peek up at the monitor, and I saw Max Kellerman and Stephen A., and Max, I think Max, he must have a personal groomer that keeps his not quite a beard, not quite stubble, absolutely perfect at 1/8 of an inch.
Right? It seems like it stays exactly that way no matter what every day.
Every day it looks the same. And as it, I don't think so. I mean, if you have a beard, then you've got the adjustments that you can always keep it at the same length every day. But that is so trimmed that it's like he has somebody coming and, you know, maybe he has a baby goat that just gnaws off just a little bit to keep it at that good level.
Did you ask Coach Q about the goat? Been found?
We talked about, no, the goat has not been found yet. I think we're all concerned about that. Yeah. We're all concerned about the goat because a goat's gone. And now, you know, it makes me wonder, is Coach maybe not feeding the goat enough or not feeding the goat the right food? Because the goat's like, yo, Coach, you know, I'd like something a little bit different than like the stuff you're giving me here. And I'm going to take off for a while. I'm going to make you pay for it. Could
oh,
be.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. Could be. You know, Derek X joins this program every other week. We've been trying to turn it into more of every week because there's so much going on in the world of boxing. The big man's in front of me right now wearing his Big D hat. How you doing?
I'm doing great, CG. Thanks for having me on.
So you're always repping the Cowboys.
Trying to. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. I love my boys.
That's you've got the classic vintage retro hat on today. It's not bright white. It's sort of just a hint of off-white with the proud block navy blue D. Do I see a hint of
silver?
A little silver around it. All right,
yes,
very nice. All right, that's if you ever come in here with a cheese head, we're going to have a problem.
No.
But Chuck in North Dakota, who listens every day on the 940 ESPN app, he would be very happy because he is a Packers fan.
All right. Well, yeah. We all have our faults.
That's very nicely played. That's absolutely. So you were telling me that the great Terrence Crawford and the great, again, Conor McGregor are talking about a dual match. My skepticism goes up immediately when I hear this, because we've seen what Conor McGregor can do in a ring. I don't know what Terrence Crawford can do in the octagon. And that's why you're here, to try to make sense of all this for all of us.
Well, this was something that Bob Arum had floated out there, that because of the Mayweather-McGregor fight, which was the second largest viewed pay-per-view event in history, I think he's trying to get Terrence Crawford out there and get him noticed a little bit more in the aspects of he needs that big marquee fight. Because Crawford, he crushed Mean Machine, but that was all the way back in December. He still has no opponent at this time for his next fight, which is kind of rare. Not even a mandatory setup yet.
Can I stop you right there?
Yes, sir.
I know we've talked about this before, but why can't he get that big fight? Because he's getting penalized for guys that don't want to go up against him, right?
He absolutely is, and that's part of the problem, and that's what is really the auspice of this McGregor-Crawford fight, is that Bob Arum had thrown him out there that, yeah, we can do MMA. We'll do MMA rules. We can do boxing under boxing rules, and we'll make it a two-bout match. Crawford used to wrestle, but back in high school. Now, he is a brawler. He's used to fighting, but he's used to using his hands more. Would he have the advantage in the boxing ring? Yes, absolutely. But if they did the MMA event first, I believe that's pretty far-fetched. If McGregor's focused,
how come,
like he was with McGregor, with Cerrone,
right,
he could do some damage to Crawford. Because Crawford is a wrestler, okay? That's totally different than being an MMA, where you're skilled in different types of disciplines, Muay Thai, being able to wrestle, to box. It's a little bit of everything.
What is a boxer's mentality? Put yourself in the shoes of Terrence Crawford, because this is really interesting to me. What is Terrence Crawford, if he gets in the octagon with a Conor McGregor, what is he thinking he can do to negate the strengths of Conor McGregor?
And that's it. That's what I don't see. I don't think that he can, unless he tries a stand-up game, because he needs to try and get McGregor to the ground if he was a wrestler. But he's not a highly accomplished wrestler. He wasn't a wrestler in college. He didn't win awards. It was something that he's done. He always dabbles in it. I don't think you don't play boxing, you don't play MMA either.
That's
especially at this label, this level. Because if you look at how McGregor was focused, how he took one of the most accomplished MMA fighters and destroyed him in 40 seconds, that's not good for Crawford. This, I know Arum is floating this out there, because what Crawford really wants is exactly what you're talking about, is he wants some of those other 147-pounders to help unify titles. The only problem is with these welterweights, Errol Spence Jr., Pacquiao, Sean Porter, Keith Thurman, even Danny Garcia, they're all under the PBC banner.
So how does, because you're saying, we're talking with Derek X as we always do, talking some boxing, a little bit of MMA, how does Terrence Crawford, who needs this big marquee fight, how does getting into the octagon with McGregor help him? It helps everybody putting the fight together, because everybody's going to make hundreds of millions of dollars. Fans are going to enjoy it because it's more spectacle. It becomes Roman Gladiator-like more than anything else. Conor McGregor has enough skill that he could probably disable a guy like him in the octagon pretty quickly. So where is the benefit for Crawford here?
Money in his pocket.
Yeah, because he needs money, doesn't he?
Well,
I mean, I'm being facetious.
The big payday, and it puts him on a more of a national or worldwide platform where people can see him. I just don't see it as a benefit, though, going up against somebody at the skill level of McGregor. No way. That's a bad deal, if you ask me straight up.
Where is the... Does reach have any effect in this? I mean, would Crawford be able to get him into a stand-up brawl? Because McGregor seems like he would be. You were talking about focus. He's mm-hmm. not drinking. He's got. We saw that in the fight with Cerrone. McGregor seems like he would simply be too smart to allow himself to get stuck into essentially a stand-up street brawl.
And you're exactly right, because he analyzes his opponents. He came up with a brand new move for Cerrone that Cerrone had never seen before, based upon hundreds of hours of tapes that McGregor watched on Cerrone's tendencies. This would happen to Crawford. This has doing the MMA at full MMA rules has no benefit for Crawford. One kick to the head, you're using different gloves, different pads, you're going to get hit differently, it's going to feel differently as opposed to wearing gloves in the boxing ring. I see what Aram's doing. He's trying to get Crawford out there, float him out there. But a two-bout match like this is exactly the word that you just said. To me, a spectacle.
And if we reverse it and go the other way, I don't know MMA the way I know boxing, and I mean my knowledge of the intricacies of the sport pales compared to yours, but when I see Conor McGregor stepping into the squared circle with Terrence Crawford, he has no shot against Terrence Crawford.
He has no shot, but let's back up a second too. When he fought Floyd Mayweather, the best fighter pound for pound that's come along, and he's a generational fighter.
Yeah.
And he was still able to go 10 rounds with him before it was stopped. Now, Crawford has more punching power than Mayweather, but that shows you that at least McGregor's got some ability to take a punch in the ring, to be able to withstand some of those combinations, you know, Crawford switching up styles, the body shots. He's used to that. So you have the ability of McGregor on one side in the MMA to take Crawford out in the first round.
How much?
I don't think that would happen in the boxing side.
As long as you open that doorway, how much of Mayweather and him going 10 rounds was it Mayweather's strategy and maybe not as good a strategy as he should have had? Because when I watch Floyd Mayweather fight, just in general, just seems like that fight should have been over in the third or fourth round.
Mayweather is tactical. Okay, he goes in there to score points, to wear you down, and where you also get wore down is you're constantly swinging and missing him.
So given what you just said, you're absolutely right. Given what you just said, didn't it seem to you like the way to not play into Conor McGregor's hands is by to basically end this thing fast?
But I don't know if Crawford has that ability.
No, and yeah.
And, you're right. That would be the way to do it. And like I was just saying, McGregor has more of the ability to end it fast in the octagon than Crawford does to end it fast in the boxing ring.
All right, that all makes sense to me. We're talking with Derek X. Let's talk about King Rye and a Valentine's Day fight.
Yes, sir. That's exactly what it is. King Rye is kind of the heartthrob for the younger generation. He's 19-0 right now. He was the 2017 Prospect of the Year. He's had kind of a tumultuous year where he had issues with trying to get the proper fights through Golden Boy. Golden Boy and Oscar De La Hoya right now are having issues with some of their main fighters. He was able to sew it up and make it better with Ryan Garcia, got him a new deal.
Undefeated, is he not?
19-0. Yep. And he had a fight scheduled, and this is where it was kind of the needle in the haystack that caused super problems with Golden Boy and Garcia. Is the last fight that he had is the gentleman, his opponent, Avery Sparrow, was arrested 24 hours before the fight on a gun charge. Then they couldn't get a replacement for him, so Garcia's like, look, I want to fight. I want to get to be more well-known. And what's happening here? And they smooth things over. He got a new deal with him. But Ryan Garcia is what some of these YouTubers are trying to be, only he has a skill. He's an accomplished amateur. He's got 4.7 million Instagram followers. And one of the interviews he had the other day, the reporter was kind of joking with him about, hey, you know, shouldn't you be posting to Instagram? And Ryan's like, I get paid good money to do that. Ryan Garcia gets paid six figures just to post on Instagram. He's that much of an influencer for his age. and what he's doing now in the ring. The fight that he has coming up with Fonseca, Fonseca's 25-2. He's a worthy opponent, but if you look at his history, most of his fights have been at super featherweight. This fight is going to be at lightweight, and Garcia has fought at both weights. Garcia is now starting to make a statement. Okay, a lot of people said that he didn't take, you know, serious opponents on him. Some of it was the Golden Boy Promotions not getting him super high quality fights, but his fights were a lot more quality than Fonseca's. And his last fight against Romero Duno, this guy had been calling him out for years. I'm a fighter from the Philippines. Even wore a shirt that says, "Quit ducking me, Ryan." Well, Ryan Garcia ended that. They had that fight in December, and Ryan Garcia, or November, he ended that in the first round with a knockout. So he's working on his skill, his speed, and if you've seen any of the videos on this, this man has intense hand speed, intense hand speed. His footwork leaves a little bit to be desired, but he's got the hand speed and his knowledge of the boxing game, especially through his trainer, Reynoso. He's going to be ready for this. He's going to make a statement. Golden Boy is looking towards the end of the year to get Ryan Garcia a title shot. If he gets that title shot, you're looking probably from a platform aspect of how visible he'll be, Floyd Mayweather status as far as being world renowned.
All right, coming up, I want to talk about Caleb Plant,
yes,
a super middleweight who's coming up on a title fight, but this is the road that this young man has been on, that he has traveled, is quite remarkable, and we're going to give you the name of his opponent. That is my new favorite name in the boxing world. His first name is Vincent. I'm just going to leave it at that before we get back.
Yes, sir.
Up. That is good stuff. Glad you're hanging out with us. Derek X is in studio. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN. Christopher Gabriel returns.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
Baby, let me be.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart. Cause you don't care about me.
Unchain my heart.
You got me sort of like a pillowcase.
Retro Bumper Friday. Ray Charles. Doesn't get much better than Ray Charles. Unless you're talking boxing. And then we talk about Derek X, who is in studio with me this morning. Always good to have big man in the house. So there is a fighter, Caleb Plant, super middleweight, coming up a title fight on February 15th.
Correct.
I believe. And it's a remarkable road that he has had to get where he's at. And his opponent is Vincent Feigenbutz. it's Feigenbutz. Maybe it's Feigenboots. I don't think it is. I think it's Feigenbutz, B-U-T-Z. That's a word, that's a name that you can really wrap your arms around. It's like a full meal name, Feigenbutz.
And it's kind of like going to Disneyland and being on It's a Small World ride. Now you're going to be saying Feigenbutz all day long.
All day long. Or you go to the great German restaurant in town and you just say, I'm going to have the Black Forest ham and a side of Feigenbutz.
There you go.
You know, now I don't want the Spetzel, I want the Feigenbutz. So tell folks, it's a great story. His story, Caleb Plant's story, is really quite remarkable.
It is. He started boxing when he was 8 years old. You know, he grew up in poverty. And this is just a feel-good story at this point. Prior points in his life, it has not been. You know, you look at his upbringing, all of the roads and obstacles that he had to go through on that. His mother, unfortunately, ended up brandishing a knife on a peace officer, and she perished in that confrontation. And then in 2015, he had a daughter who wasn't even 2 years old, who had been born with an abnormality that caused her to have a couple hundred seizures a day. And he had been told for months, you know, this is going to be her last week. This is going to be her last week. And he always said no. And they found a way to fight through it. And then the last time he went, she had also developed an infection because of it, and he could tell something was different. And he spoke with his daughter, and he said, if you need to, let go. You know, Daddy won't be disappointed in you. And as a father myself, very, very touching. So he let his daughter go, and she passed away. Mm. Where this comes to fruition is two fights ago when he won his title, he dedicated that fight to his daughter. There was nothing more emotional at that time that I had been around to see him fight through it, and it was like he was fighting for his daughter. Then he makes that announcement, and then he turns around and goes into the locker room and proposes to his fiance, Jordan Hardy. You know, and this is a man who's put his life together. I was able to come to know of him through Coach Pete, because Coach Pete and Randall Cunningham and Caleb Plant are all involved with the church in Las Vegas. And a lot of it has to do.
And we're talking about Randall Cunningham.
The Randall Cunningham, yes, sir.
He went to UNLV, did he not?
Yes,
yep.
He did.
Okay.
And they have a lot of religious things that they do that are focused on men, and men as fathers, and men as setting the right example. And Caleb Plant is doing that. So to watch him, you know, as opposed to the Gervonta Davises of the world, who are having issues making weight and other charges against them, we won't get into that, to see a man with as much tragedy as he's had in his life to do it right, win a title, and now he's up for his second mandatory title defense. This is, you know, a feel-good story.
Well, I think not only is it a feel-good story, but I think we tend to gravitate so easily to negativity. We go, and I'm not trying to make this Pollyanna-ish, but we find that negative stories, the guy who was in trouble or the gal who was in trouble, that's the low-hanging fruit in our business. And we latch onto it, and then the world of Twitter and social media more broadly starts to chime in, because it becomes a feeding frenzy of negativity. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't cover stories that involve that, but we tend to overlook some of the really great stories like this one, because for one reason or another, it's not controversial, and so some will say it's not worth our time, but it is worth our time.
It's not that flash in the pan that's required by social media, and that's one aspect of social media I do not like. It's one-way conversations, and it's the flash in the pan negativity that gets the tweets, the retweets, and the fire and all that. And you'll notice when issues like that come up, I'm ghost. I don't want anything to do with that.
You know, Caleb Plant reminds me a little bit, but for different reasons, of Jose Ramirez, a young man who, I mean, you look at Jose, and we all know his story very well.
Correct.
A young man who has been driven by his family, his faith, his community, and he has parlayed the things most important in his life into a tremendous boxing career, and somebody who has never forgotten who has helped get him to where he's at.
Exactly. And he trains with his father, so he still has that constant, you know, ability to be grounded in what he's doing. And now, and what is really scary, is he's more focused than he has been in his title fight and his first title defense. His footwork, he's called Sweet Hands because of his ability to land that good shot when it's needed, to be very precise. But it's his footwork that puts him in those places to land those shots. And he is looking very, very precise at this time. And this fight, Caleb's new home is in Las Vegas, and that's where he trains. This is going to be in Nashville, Tennessee, his fight, and it's going to be 30 minutes from where he grew up. And he always envisioned that fighting, that homecoming fight. And here he is going back to the place that brought him so many trials and trauma, and he's defending a belt.
And there is yet another parallel with Jose. When Jose has fought here at Save Mart Center and in his community, where he's not far from where he grew up.
Correct. And Caleb never, ever had the opportunity to fight in Nashville. So this is his first fight there, going back, and he has the belt. And I look for him, if we can get some of the other belt contenders in this division to start unifying, because this is his mandatory title defense for the IBF belt. I want to see him unify. We need to see some of the other 168-pounders step up and take on Caleb Plant.
You know, the amount of different organizations out there, the WBO, WBA, WBC, reminds me of college football, even though I wasn't alive in the 50s and 60s, when you had all of these different wire services and computer-generated services that would award different national championships. And you'll see teams today that will say, we've won 17 national championships, when really the only ones that have ever been the ones officially, you want to use that word, counted, are the Associated Press. And now, of course, with the playoff that we have. But it would be nice to see unification by not having all these different organizations. I know it'll never happen, but there's just so much out there. I feel like the voluminous amount of organizations dissipates the interest in people in being able to rally behind different fighters. It's not the way it used to be. And in this one instance, I think the way it used to be is better than it is now.
And I think you're right from the aspect of what it takes to unify a belt. Being... you know, in the IBF or the IBO, being a ranked contender, you actually have to pay to be under that sanctioning body's list of contenders and fighters. So you're paying a sanctioning body to rank you. That's why at times earlier you wouldn't even see Jose Ramirez ranked in the top 5 or 10 in the IBO or IBF, because he didn't pay the fees to become part of that
right.
organization. You know, then you have the more dilution of the actual validity of the belts with the WBC,
no question.
You know, doing the Taco Tuesday belts, you know.
Yeah, no question about it.
It gets a little bit insane. I wish it could go back to the core, but the problem is the four sanctioning bodies all have vastly different ideas, and they're a lot different in when it comes to drug testing, what it takes to qualify, where the rankings are at, and who becomes a mandatory.
And everybody wants to make their piece of change.
And they want to be the one.
Yep. We got 60 seconds left. Let's throw a shout out to our friend Frank Aliman.
Yeah, Frank Aliman. Don't forget, everybody, tomorrow, Saturday, February the 8th, at Aliman Gym at 1229 North Sierra Vista. Frank's going to have up to 35 bouts there. We've got Jet Blackwell, America Berber, Osmel Avila. That's just some of the big fights that we have coming on. A couple of Frank's kids, Francisco and Carlos Aliman, they'll be in the ring too. This is a great local event, folks. It's $15 to get in, but this helps contribute to a boxing facility that helps really take care of the younger kids in today's life that have nothing else to do at this time, you know, except be on the streets. Frank brings people in. He teaches them the sport. He teaches them professionalism, the fundamentals. And it's like a youth center, but it's so focused on boxing. And occasionally, you don't know who's going to walk through that door.
It's depressing to look at like 12, 13, 14-year-olds that could beat the hell out of me. It's just really depressing.
Yeah, you know? I get scared when I walk in the gym.
I've seen the video, and these kids are good. Derek, it's always great to have you in. We're out next week, but we're going to reconnect with you in 2 weeks. Lots of stuff to talk about.
Some
then,
big fights.
Yeah,
then.
No question. Tyson Fury.
Absolutely. That's Wilder with Gabe Flores on the undercard.
Yeah, that's man, I can't wait. He is Derek X. You can find him on Twitter. We put him out there as well. Coming up next, our weekend movie premieres, and also a pretty amazing series on Netflix, a documentary series. That's all next with our guy from Variety, Nick Shager. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN and 940ESPNFresno.com. More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
My bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted.
Retro Bumper Friday.
I got a cow that went dry.
Ray Charles. This is one that I always forget. This is a great one. This really is. Ray Charles. The house band today. And you know, if it is Friday and it's 8:36, you do know what that means.
There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
Our favorite film critic. He does it all. Nick Shager, Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Esquire, joining me live from 3,000 miles away. Technology is a beautiful thing. How are you, Mr. Shager?
I'm good. Happy pre-Oscars Friday morning, Christopher.
Boy, oh boy. And you know, I'm out next week, and it's next week, isn't it? Or is this week?
No, it's this week.
It's this week, okay.
This Sunday.
Okay, so I'm out next week. So when I come back in 2 weeks, we'll still have to have a Shager review of the ones that you expected and the ones that you didn't expect. Is there before we get talking here, because there's some things that I really want to get to, is there any surprise that you want to call right now, right on this program?
Well, I think that for the most part, the Oscars are going to go according to the script that the previous awards bodies have set. I think we're not in for a lot of surprises, but the one that really hangs in the balance is Best Picture. And it looks now like it's coming down to a showdown between 1917 and Parasite. One is a traditional Hollywood war film. Parasite is the first Korean film to be nominated for Best Picture. I think my dark horse pick, if I had to make a wild prediction, would be that I think Joker might win Best Picture.
It
might, come out of the blue. I think Joaquin Phoenix is definitely going to win Best Actor for it. And I think that it may benefit from a bit of vote splitting between Parasite and 1917. And then the fact that it is a sort of hot button one that made $1 billion and, you know, is a crowd pleaser, as well as being divisive and seemingly, you know, a hefty film. That would be the one I would, I guess, maybe go out on a limb for, although we'll see.
And I know, you know, I remember your reviews for both Parasite and 1917. You loved Parasite. 1917, you said that, you know, aside from some of the CGI stuff that they did that was kind of clever, that they didn't really break any exciting ground there, and yet 1917 has been a runaway hit.
It has been. It's been a big hit. I think that its technical gimmickry has won people over because it is such an impressive technical feat, and it's also a very sort of safe, comforting film. It's not really a political film in any sort of, you know, real way. It has very generic things to say about war, and so I think people have just allowed themselves to enjoy it without having to get themselves into thinking about, you know, sort of naughtier themes that maybe things like Parasite and the like have tackled. But look, it's not a terrible film, and it clearly has struck a chord with audiences and with critics. So, you know, I wouldn't bet against it per se. Although I do think Joker may sneak in there.
We're talking with Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire, as we always do every Friday at 8:35. So maybe one of the longest names of a film ever, Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. I guess when you are an actor or an actress and you have a successful spot in a film, you might get a spinoff of your own film or something similar to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's certainly what's happened here with Birds of Prey. You know, in 2016, we got Suicide Squad, which was a big DC Comics-based blockbuster that brought together all of these DC Comics villains to sort of embark on a mission to save the world, even though they were the bad guys. And the film made a lot of money, but wasn't much of a critical hit. And I think its reputation has already suffered greatly. We're going to have a direct sequel to that coming out in another year or so that's going to really be sort of a sequel slash reboot. But the one thing that definitely worked in Suicide Squad for everybody was Harley Quinn, played by Margot Robbie. Harley Quinn is, as everybody knows, the girlfriend of the Joker. She herself is sort of a clownish villain, and Margot Robbie immediately made the character her own. So here she is with her own sequel slash spinoff, and Birds of Prey is really about her efforts to sort of stand on her own two feet after what she does at the beginning of the movie, which is break up with the Joker. Now, that's a pretty good premise for the film and for the character, because the character is, by her very nature, sort of an abused and oppressed woman, sort of escaping a toxic guy here, the most toxic guy, literally and figuratively, I guess, with the Joker. And so she goes on her own sort of adventure here, which eventually winds up bringing her into contact with a lot of other female superhero-ish characters, many of whom are also dealing with sort of bad men. The main villain here is Ewan McGregor. He plays a Gotham City businessman who's really, sort of a super criminal himself. And the film, you know, really sort of rests for the most part on Margot Robbie's personality and charisma, and she's got plenty of it, and she is definitely the best part of this film. My problem with the film is it really wants to be a female version of Deadpool. It's an R-rated superhero film that's really over the top, lots of profane humor, lots of ultra violence and super slow motion enhanced action sequences, a lot of narration and rewinding and fast forwarding, so the narrative's all cut up. And the truth is, I found all of it to be very strained. It's a very candy colored confetti drenched film. It certainly has a big carnivalesque sort of style to it, but I found the whole thing trying too hard. And the biggest problem from that was that it isn't that funny. It wants to be wacky with a capital W, but it's not actually as wacky as it thinks it is. And so I found a lot of it to be fine when it came to its sort of more representational concerns, its feminist sort of angle, which felt natural to the story. But the rest of it felt very derivative, and it seemed like it was the kind of film that everybody thought was going to be this raucous good time, and yet it never actually winds up being as funny or as thrilling as it's trying to be. So I certainly think people who are interested in Harley Quinn, you know, are going to get what they expect, but I don't think it's, you know, Deadpool. Well, and I think in the long run, it's probably going to not do as well as they're hoping.
So there is one thing, if there's one thing that bothers me a lot when I watch SportsCenter, it's watching anchors trying too hard to be funny when they're not funny. Just get where I'm tuning in for the sports, not the humor. If I'm watching a play and actors are trying too hard, instead of letting the script play them, they try to play the script. And then in a film, the same thing drives me nuts. In a film where in SportsCenter, at SportsCenter, the anchors are in control of that. In a play, the actors are in control of it. But in a movie, this is where, because you have so many takes, this is where a director needs to be skilled and understand that he needs to have people, his actors, pulling back. For me, Nick, I always blame it in film when it's actors are trying too hard, a film is trying too hard to be funny. I always blame that on the director for not reeling the actors in.
Yeah, I agree completely. Some of the blame here certainly goes to a script that just doesn't have as many funny lines as it thinks it does. You know, a lot of it is just as basic as when they cut to the one-liner is not very funny. But to your point, the film as a whole, not just in terms of its writing, but in terms of its performances, in terms of its visual style, in terms of its editorial structure, when it's trying this hard, it is on the director, because there's a sense of almost here of desperation. And I say that not because the film is in a real sense desperate, but you feel this desperate hunger to be so unbelievably wacky at all times that quickly gets exhausting and gets a little annoying. And when the film is already as sort of garish as this one deliberately wants to be, I found it to just be sort of off-putting. I wished that it was trying less to be Deadpool and more to be something really unique. And it only gets there every once in a while, like at the end of the movie when they finally get everybody together. It does feel a little bit more like a wacko Batman film. But for the most part, I found it to be a little disappointing.
We're talking with Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. All right, The Lodge. Anytime, it's a horror film, anytime you've got the film that it's the snowbound house, it's the far removed resort, it's the village in the woods way off the road, you know there's problems right off the bat. There's just never go to one of those because you're going to run into problems. What I don't understand is how so many horror films And I don't know what you're going to tell me about this one, but how many horror films, Nick, end up not being horrific? They just end up being horrific in a sense of I'm not scared here.
Well, certainly there is an issue about the Snowbound Lodge as something as a convention that may be a little past its prime at this point, and that's coming from somebody who cites The Shining as one of his all-time favorites.
Love that movie.
The Lodge certainly fits a, to my mind, familiar mold. It does have its own sort of unique, you know, positives here. It's the story of a family, and in particular two kids, a brother and sister. The brother, played by Jaden Martell, who people will know from the It films. They are taken by their father to a remote snowbound lodge for Christmas. And they do this in the aftermath of their mother's death. Now, that alone is complicated by the fact that their mother has died in a suicide because their father has cheated on her. And in fact, he has cheated on her with a woman played by Riley Keough, who's going to be at the lodge. That creates a lot of tension, as you might imagine, at the lodge. And making matters worse, Riley Keough's character, Grace, is actually the only survivor of a mass suicide perpetrated by a cult that she was a member of. So we've got the setting for some bad things to happen, and unpredictably, bad things do happen. I won't give away a single thing because things start going sort of supernaturally haywire, and yet it's never clear, or at least initially not clear, why things are going haywire. The film has a lot of mood to it, and it definitely has an element of surprise. I think the problem with it is that for all of its style and for all of its mood, it doesn't have enough surprises, by which I mean when you have a premise like this, one of the things you can't do is eventually settle on the most obvious conclusion to things. And eventually, here, the film uses a lot of misdirection to wind up at a very, quote-unquote, easy place. I don't think anyone will be bowled over by how the film eventually resolves itself, because it resolves itself in sort of the way you can see coming or would have initially expected. I think a lot more surprise in that regard would have helped, even if the film keeps you on its toes in the middle of it. But Riley Keough's very good. The directors certainly know how to shoot a film. I just think, you know, given that we've already seen a lot of films like this in the past, it's not likely to break out from that pack.
Well, unless you're talking about a story set in a home in Amityville, Long Island, the supernatural stuff always happens at the snowbound home. It never, and for some reason, as you were explaining the story, I had a flashback to Children of the Corn.
Well, Children of the Corn, which, you know, unsurprisingly, I just watched pretty recently.
Of course.
because why wouldn't I
yes,
be? My
yes.
kids eventually had to be introduced to those kids. you know, that's another movie that, you know, is fun until you realize that eventually where you thought things had to head is exactly where we're heading.
Yeah, I sometimes make that reference with my daughters. I'll be like, don't act like Children of the Corn. And they have no idea what I'm talking about, which is really good, because when they discover that, they'll be like, why are you saying that? Why are you saying that to us? One more thing with Nick Shager is next. I can't wait for him to explain this new documentary series on Netflix called The Pharmacist. This, I cannot wait to watch this, and he will roll it out. That's up next. One more thing for you on this beautiful Friday in the Central Valley. This is the CGP.
You're listening to the Christopher Gabriel Program on 940 ESPN.
Well, I got a woman way over town that's good to me.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing for you today, Retro Bumper Friday, Ray Charles.
Way over town.
Nick, I can't wait to watch this. I'm not sure if it's out. It's out yet, meaning it was out this past Wednesday or it's out next Wednesday, but it is The Pharmacist. I read your piece on it, and I also saw the trailer, and this just looks absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and it is out now, so you can go home later tonight and start checking it out. The Pharmacist is on Netflix. As we make clear almost every week here, Netflix is the king of true crime stories, but The Pharmacist is a different sort of true crime story in the sense that we're not talking about an unsolved mystery. We're talking about a really heartening story about a man named Dan Schneider, who was a Louisiana resident, lived right outside of New Orleans, in right outside the Ninth Ward, actually, the lower Ninth Ward. And in the 1980s, he had what seemed like the perfect life until one fateful evening, his son, his teenage son, went into the lower Ninth Ward to buy drugs and was killed in a shooting. And this was a tragedy that rocked his world, as everyone could rightfully imagine. And then that inspired Schneider to go after the killer because the police had no leads, and Schneider was determined to find justice for his son. So the first part of The Pharmacist is really a story about a father looking to find the person or persons who took his son's life. And that alone is an amazing story because Schneider is really an amazing guy. He was this local town pharmacist, but he went through an unbelievable amount of sleuthing on his own to track down the people who might have perpetrated this. But the story doesn't end there. In fact, it only sort of just begins because after he had sort of quote-unquote solved the case of his son's murder, he realized that his son was the victim of a much larger crisis, and that was the opioid crisis that was really hitting his neighborhood and neighborhoods all around the country so horribly hard, in large part because of prescription drugs and OxyContin. That led to an amazing, amazing story where he goes after a local doctor who was basically operating as a drug dealer. I mean, with lines out the door and working at 11 p.m. at night just selling prescriptions. And then that led to a bigger battle with the pharmaceutical companies, including a big one here in my own hometown of Stamford, Connecticut. And so the story really has both an intimacy and a larger wide-scale view of this crisis. It's a fascinating, fascinating watch. As I said, you know, Netflix is really great at true crime, but this is a unique one people should check out.
And there was, we've got about a minute and a half. There was one line, your review on this, and you talked about it. It's a great piece on Daily Beast, but there was one line that really stuck out that you wrote, and this is what Nick said. Through it all, Schneider comes across as a man possessed almost to an unhealthy degree. That really is a phenomenal insight on this man.
Yeah, well, you know, as everybody knows, you know, being obsessed with something can obviously lead to bad things as well. And this is a guy who really put his own life at risk. I mean, legitimately being chased down the street and going into neighborhoods where, you know, middle-aged white guys shouldn't be going safely and put his family at risk. And you know, even authorities couldn't believe what this guy was doing. But sometimes those are the lengths you have to do to you know, really get things accomplished. And in many respects, it's a story about courage.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And once again, folks, he is Nick Shager, Daily Beast, Variety, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. Great stuff. You can find him on Twitter, and you need to find him on Twitter because then you get to go right to his reviews, which are terrific, and his interviews with directors, you name it. At N as in Nick, S as in Sam, C as in Christopher, H-A-G-E-R, at Nick Shager. Abbreviated. Nick, always great stuff, my man. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again in a couple of weeks.
Looking forward to it, Christopher. Have a great weekend.
All right. Have a great Oscar, as Oscar's a show as well. I wonder if Nick has been to one of those. I need to ask him that. My thanks to Nick Shager and our Encore of the Week, Congressman Jim Costa, talking about Tom Flores and Derek X doing a little boxing. Gonzo, usual outstanding week. Thank you, sir. You'll have it. Will you have the call on the women's game tomorrow? Okay, that'll be on 790, the Deuce, and then we reconvene here on Monday. Folks, have a great weekend. Until we see you again, you're on your own.
It seems so hard to live. when I wake and find that you're not.
Your home of Fresno State football.
To Harper, a stiff arm, sending him off all the way to the goal line. Touchdown, Fresno State.
940 ESPN, KFIG, Fresno.